Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week, I'll be joined by Ian Millhiser from the Center for American Progress, and we will talk about some progress on a voting rights case this week. We'll also talk a little bit about Robert Mueller's probe into potential crimes surrounding the Trump regime and Russia. Then we'll be joined by Rebecca Labor from Mother Jones to talk about Trump's decision to pull out of the Paris Climate Accord. It was reported that what pushed him over the top was the idea of pissing off the Europeans. Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, he talked about having bested Trump in that weird game of violent handshaking he likes to play. And so Trump wanted to stick it to the French. He wanted to stick it to the Germans. And that was supposedly one of the deciding factors. And this is exactly how internet trolls operate, how online trolls see the world. They say or do dumb, offensive, ridiculous things to trigger the snowflakes, to piss off the left. It's so embarrassing that this is the president of the United States. And finally, we'll be joined by Suna Amhaz, the co-editor of a book of photographs of the early stages of the anti-Trump resistance. I should note that I just returned from the March for Truth. Suna and her co-author Mark Mendoza are going to publish a follow-up with photographs from this and other protests. But first, a few items you may have missed. On Memorial Day, there were, you know, parades and bunting, and people drank beer and ate greasy barbecue, and all. It was all very patriotic. I had a good time myself. But in Juarez, Mexico, just over the Rio Grande from El Paso, Texas, there was an unusual protest on Memorial Day. A dozen or so men who had served in the U.S. military, with the expectation that it would lead to U.S. citizenship. So these are men who literally risked their lives and had subsequently been deported. And many of them, I should say, were deported under Obama. So we can't put this one on Trump, or not entirely, but I think it's safe to say it's a national disgrace. It's a national disgrace. Speaking of immigrants, do you remember during the campaign when Donald Trump would parade around these families who had lost a loved one to an undocumented immigrant? They had like a relative who had been killed by a drunk driver with no papers or whatever. And Trump rather shamelessly exploited their tragedies, exploited them to demagogue migrants, right? Never mind that immigrants commit crimes at a lower rate than the native-born. That's reality, right? Anyway, according to Ken Fogle at Politico, some of those families are now feeling, and I quote, used and abused and exploited by Trump and by the Remembrance Project, which is a nonprofit that backed him. This nonprofit raised a bunch of money ostensibly to help these families, but hasn't given them any of it. And the leader of the group said, yeah, basically, we raised money for all the families, but that doesn't mean it was ever our intent to share it with them. It's just quite a brazen bit of grifting. Everybody who touches Trump gets screwed over that way. I think that this is just, it's like death taxes, and Trump will take your lunch money. Pennsylvania lawmakers are considering a bill that would make gun owners a protected class under the state's Human Rights Act. And you'd think the gun would provide enough protection, but no. At issue is the fact that some employers don't allow their workers to bring guns to work. And of course, gun owners are special snowflakes who deserve special rights. And I'd like to just pause here and note that in Pennsylvania, sexual orientation and gender expression are not included in the Human Rights Act. So, you can scream discrimination. If this bill passed, you could scream discrimination if your boss tells you that you can't bring your gun to work, but not if your boss fires you because you're gay. So, priorities. Finally, I don't know if you've been paying attention to this weird pseudo-scandal that congressional Republicans are wasting serious time and energy on, and tax dollars. Certain American figures in Trump's orbit were quote-unquote unmasked. This is when there are intercepted communications between an American and a foreigner. So they sweep up all this data, and any American who's caught in that data, their identity must be hidden unless they get a court order, but also a senior official can request that it be revealed in the course of an investigation. Anyway, Justice Department officials had several people in Trump's orbit unmasked because they were sneaking around having a bunch of covert meetings with the Russians, right? That's why. This is routine. They were doing their jobs. But here's the thing. Donald Trump sent out that silly tweet accusing Barack Obama of wiretapping his campaign offices, and everyone was like, this guy sounds crazy. Of course that never happened. So the House Intelligence Committee, which is supposedly investigating Russian meddling in the election, but is actually running interference for Donald Trump, came up with this bogus scandal to retroactively justify his wacky tweet. And they accused Democrats baselessly of improperly unmasking U.S. citizens. And they said, oh, that must have been what Trump was talking about. It's not. And that silly pseudo-scandal fell apart completely last week when the Washington Post reported that the very same House Intelligence Committee had requested that several people close to Trump be unmasked in the course of their Russian investigation. They did the exact same thing. So, way to step on a rake, boys. And of course, it's important to understand that that undermines not only unmasked Ghazi, but all of their Russian talking points. Because remember, all of this Russia talk is supposed to be about Democrats making excuses for Hillary Clinton's loss. And it's hard to understand why the House Intelligence Committee, run by Republicans, would do such a thing. Anyway, with that, let's move along. We'll take a quick break, and then we'll be right back.
All of the DJs surely have taken a lesson. Start talking trash, and I'll come with my Smith & Wesson. A little competition comes my way. What about it? It always winds up the same. But the stone that the builder refused shall be the cornerstone.
Messing around, better I think of your future. Time we straighten right out. Or you'll wind up in jail.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah. That's why you're the judge and I'm the law-talking guy.
The lawyer.
Right.
Welcome back to the show. I'm joined now by Ian Millhiser. He's a law-talking guy and a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and the editor of Think Progress Justice. Ian, welcome back to Politics and Reality Radio.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
I want to talk to you about what's going on in Washington, but before we get into that, let me just ask you about a recent development in the fight against these voter suppression laws. A couple of weeks ago, the Supreme Court refused to take up a lower court's ruling that North Carolina's super aggressive voter suppression laws were racially discriminatory. And then this week we saw a semi-victory in Texas, not a full victory, but a semi-victory. Tell us a little bit about this latest case.
Sure. So what happened in Texas, and I think your read on it really is going to depend on how pessimistic you are about the Supreme Court. So Texas had a very aggressive voter ID law that, like, they didn't even really try to pretend that this wasn't a voter suppression law. They let people vote if they have a gun license, but not if they have a student ID. So it was really clear that this was a way to make sure that less Democrats would vote. And the law was struck down by a federal appellate court. And then there was a court order in place that weakened it without eliminating it. And the state legislature just passed, the governor just signed a bill that essentially makes that weakening of the law permanent. And so the reason why I say, like, how you feel about it depends on how pessimistic you are about the Supreme Court is that if you think that the Supreme Court was ultimately going to do the right thing, then this is not a great development because it means that it's now more likely that what remains of the law is going to stick around, and that is going to lead to some people who should be able to vote not being able to vote. But if you're a pessimist like me and think that the Supreme Court probably has 5 votes right now to uphold the really aggressive forms of voter suppression, then I think that this development out of Texas is a very good thing because it means that Texas is saying that they are going to accept a weaker version of the law rather than pushing to try to get the full law upheld by the court.
And ultimately, there is a contingent in this country that is arguing that if you pass a voter suppression law in order to suppress a partisan vote as opposed to a racial minority, then that should be kosher, right?
Right. I mean, yeah, the law dealing with voting right now is really, it's really shocking the things that people can get away with. So we still have at least most of the Voting Rights Act intact. And the Voting Rights Act deals with racial voter discrimination. And we have the 15th Amendment, which says explicitly that you can't discriminate on the basis of race in voting. So what you've seen a lot of states do is they pass laws which turn out to disenfranchise a lot of black and brown people. And then when they're called on it, they say, oh, no, we didn't pass this because we don't want black people to vote. We passed this because we don't want Democrats to vote. And there's some judges who have said, oh, yeah, that's fine. You can disenfranchise people because they're Democrats, even though we also have a First Amendment in the Constitution, and the First Amendment prohibits discrimination on the basis of viewpoint. So I think, like, that is a big looming fight. And, like, the court has, you know, said some things around the edges of that fight. There was a decision just a few weeks ago would suggest that maybe there aren't 5 justices who are willing to say that, oh, yeah, so long as you say it's Democrats and not race, then you can do it. But I think that's going to be one of the big looming questions in the next 5 years around voting rights, possibly in the next 1 or 2 years around voting rights, is this question of whether or not when you have a law that both like disenfranchises a lot of people that disproportionately targets people who are people of color, but also has a huge partisan impact, whether the state can essentially get out of a lawsuit by claiming that is partisan and not racial.
We had a researcher from UCSD on the show talking about their study, which found that strict voter ID laws suppressed Democratic turnout by almost 9 percentage points and Republican turnout by around 3.5 points. So it's this really stunning gap. But I should point out that that looked at strict ID requirements. So what Texas has done now is they've said you can use a phone bill, you can use a government check, you can use a number of different forms of ID that are easier to get a hold of than a state-issued photo ID might be. And, you know, we do see these stories. They are anecdotal, but you see them on a regular basis of some, you know, elderly person who just cannot prove that they were born at a certain time and place, and they are, you know, they go through these unbelievable ordeals trying to get the proper identification. It should be a major scandal, and of course all of this is predicated on a complete non-issue, which is in-person voter identification fraud. So I mean, it's maddening. It really is maddening, and it's an assault on democracy. And we have this real asymmetry in that you have two political parties, and one of them does not believe in the basic tenets of democracy, and that's a real problem. Anyway, let's talk a little bit about what Donald Trump calls the Russia thing and efforts to
speaking
get to
of
the bottom
not,
of that.
Not believing in democracy.
Yes, exactly. So Robert Mueller was appointed a special counsel. He has a reputation as a pretty thorough investigator. But some are saying, look, his appointment might actually make it more difficult to fully flesh out what U.S. intelligence agencies called a multifaceted Russian influence campaign in 2016. Ian, why would that be?
Sure. I mean, this was David Frum's argument in The Atlantic, which is essentially that a special prosecutor's job is to investigate crimes. And A, it's not clear yet what, if any, crimes were committed by Trump or the Trump campaign. And B, the crime might not be the most important thing here. It may turn out that the biggest deal is that there was some attempts to cover it up after the fact. And that's not really what we should be concerned about. If what we need to be concerned about is that a hostile foreign power is influencing our election. So the alternative, or at least something that could supplement a special counsel, is that you could have either an independent investigation, something similar to the 9/11 commission, or you could have a special congressional panel that does a more wide-ranging inquiry that doesn't just ask what were any crimes committed here, but that asks, you know, the broader, more important question, what, you know, in what way is the United States vulnerable and how can we fix it? The one thing I would say about that argument, though, is I think it's right if you presume that the people who are involved in that investigation are acting in good faith. I mean, the reason why the 9/11 commission worked to the extent that it did is because the members of that commission, for the most part, weren't looking to score partisan points. They were trying to make sure another 9/11 wouldn't happen. And so we could trust them to use good judgment. I just don't know how in this political environment you assemble such a commission today. I think what you're going to wind up with is you're going to wind up with a lot of Republicans on the commission that just want to protect their president. And you'll probably wind up with Democrats who have to defend against those tactics with similar tactics. And so it may be that the special counsel is the best that we can hope for.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. The 9/11 commission, and just so listeners recall, it was 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats. Then it was chaired by Keene. What was his first name?
Lee.
The former governor of New Jersey, Governor Keene. I don't recall his first name offhand.
Lee Hamilton was the vice chair. Yeah,
and then Lee Hamilton was the vice chair. But what I think. It was important about that committee, that commission and its members is that either all or most of them were retired politicians and were not seeking office and did not have to worry about re-election and going back to the base and all of that stuff. Is there any reason to think there have been kind of scattered reports, right? We have these two congressional probes, one in the Senate, one in the House. Both have, we have good reason, according to a number of news reports, to think that these are both ineffective, and the House is especially a joke. In the wake of the Comey firing, there was some media stories that suggested that they were becoming more serious. Do you have a sense of whether that's true or not?
I mean, I don't know anything more than what's been reported in the press, and I don't think that very many people will know more until Mueller starts taking action. So, in fact, in the short term, I think one consequence of Mueller being appointed is that we're going to know less than we would have known otherwise. And the reason for that is that, you know, right after the Comey firing, when it looked like Trump was engaged in some, you know, pretty anti-democratic, potentially authoritarian tactics, and there wasn't going to be any kind of check on that, you saw a bunch of leaks come out. And I think that those leaks happened because you had a bunch of people in the intelligence community, you know, in the law enforcement community, who were looking at what was happening, were scared about what Trump was doing, and seeing nothing else they could do about it, started making information public in the hopes that that would provide the check that they felt was needed. Once we got a special counsel, once Mueller was appointed, I think that in the short term, that's going to slow down the leaks, because now those very same elements who are frightened are going to say, good, there's an official process now, there's a legitimate sanction process by which we can figure out what's going on, and so let's let that process play out. Now, what we eventually get from Mueller, a lot of it is going to depend on, you know, what in fact is out there. And, you know, we're getting bits and snippets. You know, we're hearing that Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, may be a person of interest. We know that Michael Flynn, the former national security advisor, is very much at the center of this investigation. We hear about various campaign operatives being involved. But I think it will probably be a while, because, I think what Mueller's going to want, and I think this is probably the correct posture, is, you know, not to have information trick out in bits and pieces so that no one is really sure what's going on. And by the time people figure out the full picture, it seems like old news. He's going to want to put the pieces together. And then once the pieces are together, you know, we're probably going to get, you know, whether it's a report or a prosecution or both, we'll probably find out more about what's going on.
Okay. it was Thomas Kane. That's the way the mind works.
Yes.
When you're trying to remember something, it doesn't happen. Then when you're talking about something else, it pops into your head. I want to just circle back. Senator Mark Warner said that he had information that the Kremlin had employed 1,000 people to sit there and make fake news stories, derogatory news stories about Hillary Clinton, and spread it on social media. Let's say that the Trump campaign was not involved in that. Let's say that there was no direct collusion. Is that, they're not violating any laws, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, if the Trump campaign merely was the incidental beneficiary of this activity, you know, I mean, if someone robs a bank and I own a store and they come to my store and buy a bunch of stuff with the stolen money that they have, I haven't committed a crime unless in some way I'm like aware of or complicit in the bank theft, from the fact that I have benefited from their crime. And so normally, you know, if you are merely the incidental, you know, benefactor from someone's crime, that is not a crime. But we don't know that. There are certainly signs. You know, you have a number of people very close to Trump who have a record of doing business with Russia. You have Trump, you know, actively saying in a press in a press event, oh yeah, like I want the Russians to keep looking into Hillary Clinton. I think it's great that they're leaking this stuff. So you know, if in fact he had nothing to do with it, no one in his campaign had anything to do with it, they didn't even know it was going on. Like the only thing that they knew about was what they read in the papers. Then that means that there's no crime there, but we don't know that yet.
But this gets to the point that you made earlier about the special counsel, which is that at present, and is this a fair statement? At present, despite everything trickling out in the news, there is no serious, credible investigation looking into the totality of Russia's influence campaign. Mueller is not going to concern himself with Russian PR efforts, with the Russian media. Those things are outside of his domain. We don't have an investigation that is trustworthy looking at this comprehensively. Is that correct?
Right. Yeah. I mean, like Mueller's mission is not, I mean, like the 9/11 Commission's mission was figure out how this could happen and what we need to do to make sure it never happens again. And that's not his mission. You know, he does not have a broad mandate to figure out how the Russians hacked our election and make sure that our next election doesn't have this happen. That's not his job. His job is to figure out if any crimes were committed by Donald Trump or people associated with the Trump campaign. That said, I don't think that his investigation, even if no crimes were committed by anyone on the campaign during the campaign, I think that a lot could come of his investigation, if for no other reason because Trump is so incompetent.
Yes.
You know, Mueller doesn't just have the power to investigate what happened during the campaign. He also has the power to investigate matters that arise in his investigation, so if he discovers some other criminal activity going on, and he has the power to prosecute illegal efforts to interfere with his own investigation. So bear in mind, this guy is already investigating someone who was dumb enough to think that the way to make the FBI investigation go away was to fire the FBI director, and no one would notice.
Oh, and then go on television and say why.
Yeah, exactly. So I mean, at least Nixon had a sophisticated, legal mind when he was thinking about how to engage in a cover-up of Watergate. That's not what you got right now in the Oval Office. I think we need an investigation to how this happened, but I think that the likelihood that Mueller's going to wind up coming up with nothing is fairly small.
I agree with that. And the cover-up, as they say, can be worse than the crime. I have said many times that we would be really – things are bad, but we would be really, truly, genuinely screwed if this regime had even a minimal amount of competence and discipline. Things could be so much worse. I mean, it's just remarkable that we're being saved by their ineptitude and the fact that the president is a crackpot with a Twitter account. Ian Millhiser, I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today. I really do appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
Folks, stay tuned. We're going to take a quick break and then come right back.
Understand this cat of the slum had a mind and wasn't dumb. But a weakness was shown, cause his hustle was wrong. His mind was his own, but the man lived alone. Ooh, Superfly, you're gonna make your fortune bye-bye. But if you lose, don't ask no questions why. The only game you know is do or die. The game he plays for keeps. Hustling times in ghetto streets.
Demonstrated real leadership. We've demonstrated real progress, but
Vice President Mike Pence,
for some reason or another, this issue of climate change has emerged as a paramount issue for the left in this country and around the world. And
yes, why in the world are those crazy leftists so concerned with a potential global environmental catastrophe that's already causing serious harms and might just fundamentally reshape our biosphere? And let me also take this moment to note that American conservatives are the only ones in the world who deny climate science en masse. This kind of denialism does exist in the UK and in Australia to a degree, but the American Republican Party is really unique in its widespread dismissal of the science as a position, like a litmus test position within the party almost.
And through Kyoto, through President Obama's cap and trade agenda, and then through in the last year of his administration, to have America saddled in an international agreement in the Paris Accord, I think put a real burden on our economy and on our people. It was a bad deal for America. And as the president said so memorably yesterday, he was elected to represent Pittsburgh, not Paris.
Note that he said Pittsburgh. He chose a inland city that's at 700 feet above sea level. I think that was smart. He could have said Palm Beach, but that wouldn't have worked out very well. And the city of Pittsburgh issued a resolution saying that they support the Paris Climate Accord. As for hurting American business, well, here's Nancy Pelosi.
How are you? Almost every school child in America knows more about the climate challenge than apparently the president of the United States. He lives in a fact-free zone. His speech was based on White House counsel memo that was incorrect. It was false. He does not know anything about the agreement that he is walking away from. He cited an MIT study that the agreement would slow global warming by a tiny, tiny amount. But MIT officials rejected that statement today, and they have said actually the reverse, that without the agreement, the acceleration of global warming would go forward. They said that Trump misunderstood. That's a generous word, their study.
Welcome back. I am Joshua Holland, and I'm happy to be joined by Rebecca Labor, who is a kick-ass reporter for Mother Jones. Rebecca, welcome back to the show.
Yeah, it's great to be back on.
Is that your official title, kick-ass reporter?
I'd like it to be.
Okay, I'm going to call you that. I guess we shouldn't be surprised by Donald Trump's announcement that he will pull out of the climate accord, the Paris deal. He said he'd do it repeatedly during the campaign. He also said that climate change is a hoax perpetrated by the Chinese to destroy American capitalism. But having said that, I have to say that I am somewhat surprised anyway, in the sense that it seems so counterproductive. And the business community, I thought that the business community would have more more clout with the administration. And I sort of expected wiser heads to prevail, as they appear to have done with the Iran nuclear deal. Are you at all surprised by this?
It's hard to be surprised by what Trump does at this point.
Yes.
He essentially, he did say he would do this during the campaign, and then I guess many got their hopes up the last few months that he delayed and delayed this decision. But I can't say I'm surprised, and that's not quite the reaction I've heard from others.
Yeah. And it should be noted that there were reports, and we don't know who's leaking what, but Steve Bannon and Pruitt, the EPA, the climate change denying EPA director, apparently had a tug of war with Ivanka Trump and others. Again, these may be kind of self-serving leaks from Ivanka Trump. But apparently what ultimately won the day is that Donald Trump simply did not know what was in the climate accord, what the deal does. And as you wrote at Mother Jones, you have a piece at motherjones.com, all one word, titled "Trump Has No Idea What He Just Did or the Backlash That Awaits." Tell us what we can expect. What is the backlash that awaits?
Well, the gist of that piece is that the rest of the world has rallied behind this agreement. And we've seen that, especially in the last year, that this agreement went into force, meaning it reached a certain threshold of approval in record time. This is not the same thing as the Kyoto deal of more than a decade ago. And the backlash that we've already seen is happening both at home and internationally. Trump has been facing several angry CEOs, or probably more than several, who were lobbying in favor of the Paris deal and have now withdrawn from one of his councils. But there's also potential for backlash abroad. And that's because the rest of the world has rallied behind this agreement. And just yesterday, there was some very harsh reaction to Trump's decision to withdraw the U.S. and retreat on climate change.
Now, I think Trump and his supporters believe that going it alone and rejecting these international institutions, not just the Paris Climate Accord, but also his lack of commitment, or his kind of flip-flopping commitment to NATO, makes us stronger. Is that the opposite of reality? I mean, are we just throwing away an enormous amount of influence?
Well, it's been compared to a power vacuum that Trump, by pulling out of the Paris Agreement and the U.S. withdrawing on its climate leadership, creates this power vacuum that is bound to be filled. There is a lot of interest in acting on climate change or pursuing a renewable energy future. And if the U.S. is not going to lead on that, other countries will. So there is some interesting diplomatic impacts both on the U.S. and in ways that might help countries that are opposed to U.S. interests. And one example that I cited in my story was Russia. We saw that with Kyoto, that Russia used the U.S.'s withdrawal as leverage to gain its own gain entry into the World Trade Organization and to advance its economic interests.
And Trump gave an address. He received applause from the, no doubt, carefully selected audience, when he announced the withdrawal, and his speech was just riddled with inaccuracies. I mean, there was a false statement in almost every sentence. And, you know, let me ask you this, Rebecca. Can you give us a sense of what it would have cost us to stay in? I mean, this is a deal that is non-binding, right?
So the framework, you're right, it has non-binding targets that each country has put forward. And these are nationally determined targets. The accord by design is non-binding. There's an expectation, but no requirement that countries contribute to the Green Climate Fund, which contributes funds to developing countries and poorer nations that are adapting to climate change. And the partially binding elements of the treaty is just, sorry, accord, is just that countries commit to a certain level of transparency and returning to the negotiating table every few years. So Trump actually admitted in his speech that these are non-binding targets, which was interesting enough because it seems to counter his own claim in that same speech that this will hurt the U.S. economy. And I think with the reaction that you've seen from businesses, cities, states, and really a huge majority that Trump isn't listening to, that it won't hurt the economy, that when he cited job loss studies, those looked at a very one-sided approach and didn't look at the benefits of acting on climate change or the problems with their modeling. So you're right, there were a lot of falsehoods in that speech. And he twisted those facts to make it look like the best decision for the U.S.
The analysis that he used looked at potential harms in terms of job loss using econometric models that are dubious, although they are accepted within the industry, but it did not look at any potential benefits. So if you have, if you only look at one side of just about anything, any policy imaginable, you will get a really skewed perspective of it. And I would point out that by ceding leadership on climate, and specifically by cutting research and development funding as the president's budget would do if it were passed, you're gonna lose a lot of potential jobs in the green energy sector to the Chinese, to others. Switzerland is leading on, I forget which technology, maybe it was solar. There's just everybody else is developing these new technologies, and we're going to fall behind, and that's going to cost us economically as well as in terms of the climate. And of course, we are ceding moral leadership in many, many different areas, and it's a really disturbing trend. Rebecca Labor, I know you are on your way to a wedding, and I really want to take the moment to thank you for offering to speak to us today.
Great chatting.
And we'll be right back after this break.
First things first, I'ma say all the words inside my head. I'm fired up and tired of the way that things have been. Oh, ooh, the way that things have been. Oh, ooh. Second thing, second, don't you tell me what you think that I can be. I'm the one at the sail, I'm the master of my sea. Oh, ooh, the master of my sea. Oh, ooh. I was broken from a young age, taking my soak into the masses, writing my poems for the few that look at me, took to me, shook at me, feeling me, singing from heartache, from the pain, taking my message from the veins, speaking my lesson from the brain, seeing the beauty through the... Let the bullets fly, let them rain.
was choking in the crowd, building my rain up in the cloud, falling like ashes to the ground, hoping my feelings, they would drown, but they never did, ever lived, ebbing and flowing, inhibited, limited, till it broke open and rained down, it rained down like... flames, you're the face of the future, the blood in my veins, oh ooh, the blood in my veins, oh ooh. But they never did, ever lived, ebbing and flowing, inhibited, limited, till it broke open and rained down, it rained down like...
Welcome back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland. I'm joined now by Suna Amhaz. She is the co-author, or co-curator, maybe a better word, I'm not sure, of Crooked. It's a book of photographs. I got to tell you, I found it really stirring. It's a book of photographs taken during protests in the early months of the anti-Trump resistance. The resistance is something we've talked a lot about. It's the silver lining in this otherwise dark era. Suna, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you. Feel welcomed.
So tell me about the book. So what is Crooked?
So Crooked is a photo book of, and I think you were doing a great job explaining it beforehand. We crowdsourced photos of the best protest signs that we saw during the Women's March and the travel ban. We would go to these marches and afterwards, or these demonstrations, and we'd always try to find articles. HuffPo would have them, or BuzzFeed, and like the 10 best signs from the protests, and, you know, something you could giggle at, or, you know, or could move you during this horrible, horrible time. And I think it was a sense of relief for a lot of people to be able to see just the ingenuity and comedic gems people could come up with in such a dire time. So I remember Mark Mendoza, who is my co-curator, we'll go with that, we'd been talking on Messenger, and he asked what I'd seen that after the travel ban demonstration we'd gone to, if we'd seen any photos of like the best signs. And we started talking about how we wish there was one place where we could view all of them. And we searched to see if there was anything out there, and we couldn't find anything. So we just decided to make one ourselves.
I've spoken to a lot of people who are active in the resistance, and I keep hearing the story again and again. Well, various stories about how the election of Donald Trump shifted them from being couch potatoes to being activists. What is your background? What is Mark Mendoza's background? Are you guys like longtime activists, or did something change?
So Mark actually worked with the Nevada team on Barack Obama's campaigns in the past, and I used to phone bank for our local office positions. And it was always like on the left side, but and that was the extent of it, at least for me and Mark. We, you know, keep up with the news. We had a debate background, so we were both part of our debate teams in high school. and then it's been really interesting to see a lot of people, at least from our perspective, because we're in the Bay Area, that were super interested in tech and would call themselves hackers or hustlers, and slowly they became political pundits, and now they're political analysts all of a sudden, without necessarily having that been the interest for them. I think this sparked everybody across all industries, because I think for the first time we're realizing the gravity of the situation and how this is directly impacting us. Yes, politics has always been important, but it's never, at least for a lot of us in more privileged positions, don't see it directly affecting us. And now we're seeing it happen and happen immediately.
Right.
So that definitely lit the fire in our belly, I suppose. Or
and for you, there's a personal kind of backstory to this, to the Trump travel ban, his demagoguery of Syrian refugees. These things aren't just news stories for you, right?
Right. So when I was 12, I was born and raised in the U.S. and I'd lived in Nevada my entire life. We went to travel to Lebanon. My parents are both Lebanese immigrants, and we went to meet our entire extended family who resides in the country part of Lebanon. And we'd been there for, I'd say, a week, and we're just getting used to, you know, the languages after we were adjusted to the food and water, and, you know, after all that, getting sick and adjusting to the actual country. I remember one day we woke up to a news story that was breaking on the TV, and they talked about how the only airport in Lebanon had been struck by an airstrike that come from the Israeli army. And I don't think I understood what was happening at the time. At first, I thought it was surreal. I thought this was a movie. I wasn't processing that we were actually in danger. And then the broadcaster said that Lebanon and Israel had officially declared war. And this wasn't a war between military forces. This was military and civilians. So actual villages were being bombed. There's one night where there were four complexes, and three of them were bombed, and ours was the only one that wasn't.
Wow.
And so it was pretty dire, is the picture I'm painting. And we eventually made the decision to leave. The drive over and where we were going to was Syria, because Syria was stable. It was in 2006. It was a lot more stable than it is now. And the decision to leave was very hard, because it's not a simple trip over that you're just, you know, it's like around the corner and you're parking and you're fine. It is a long stretch of desolate land, the border between Lebanon and Syria. And it is, the border ended up being the most dangerous part, because that's what gets bombed the most. It's a pretty dangerous zone to be traveling in. So the decision, you don't make the decision to drive that distance unless you're desperate. So
right,
it was a really it was a really stressful 10 hours. And we finally got to Syria, and we were, I think there were plenty of Lebanese refugees coming in to Syria at the time. So the wait to even get past customs and have all have everything vetted and actually get in was a little lengthy. But they were so warm and welcome and opening to us. And they I remember we initially arrived at a house with a family, and they only had limited amounts of beds, and their kids were willing to sleep on the floor to let us sleep on the beds, because they'd known how hard it was for us for the past 3 weeks. And I'd never seen an act of like selflessness like to that degree. So then let's fast forward 11 years. I come and I see the Syrian refugees who were in the same, actually way worse circumstances that we had been in, trying right. to come to the U.S., who is economically well, like far better off than they were when they housed us, right? And yes. to see us slam the door in their faces and detain them, it's inhumane. I think that was the moment I decided I wasn't going to be able to just sit there. I had to pay it forward. I just couldn't do nothing.
And I should point out that the profits from this book are not going into your pocket, right?
Nope. Mark and I felt very uncomfortable paying ourselves. We didn't feel like this is anything that people should be profiting off of. The contributions go to nonprofits. Specifically, they go to the American Refugee Committee, Reading Partners, and Planned Parenthood.
While we dither over allowing a few thousand refugees in, while we demagogue them and call them terrorists, the real refugee crisis, the brunt of the refugee crisis, is being felt by the Jordanians and the Lebanese, and the Turks and the Greeks. We're only getting a very small amount of that. So I have to say that looking through the book, I found it emotionally stirring. I found myself really responding to it. I think that there's a sense, it's been so stressful under Trump. It's just, there's this daily stress. You know, we don't know what's going on with the Russia thing, and every day there seems to be a new outrage. You know, you just get accustomed to the fact that he's blowing up the Western alliance and NATO, and boom, he withdraws from the Paris Climate Accord. It's one thing after the other. And I think that looking through the pages, seeing these, all of these people coming out and their creativity in fighting back, standing up to this, gives you a sense of camaraderie that will prevail over the long run. On the cover, it says volume one. Is there more to come?
Yes. So funny story about, on the note of you saying that all of these stories that are dropping, and as soon as you think you've caught up or understood one story, the next one hits the wire. So this initially started out as a Women's March photo book. And right when we were done and ready to go to publish and have it printed, the travel ban was dropped. So we had to go back to the drawing board and crowdsource more photos. And then we decided that we realized then that this was going to be a long, arduous, hopefully not 4 years, but we'll see. So we realized there's going to be plenty of protests. So this is just volume one. We thought we were being presumptive, but honestly, this is the reality of things now. So volume two is going to cover the March for Science and the March for Truth, which is just today's June 2nd. So that will be tomorrow and June 3rd.
Yes, it is. Okay, very good. And where can people go and purchase the book?
So we have our website up. It's Crooked Mag. That's crookedmag.com. And if you want to submit your photos from the March for Science or the March for Truth, you can also submit those to crookedmag@gmail.com. And we'd really appreciate that.
Suna Amhaz, I really want to thank you for taking the time to speak with me today. I do appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me. This was an awesome opportunity. I'm really glad to get the word out.
I'd also like to thank Ian Milheiser and Rebecca Labor. You can follow me on Twitter @Joshua Hall. You can send an email griping about the show to politicsandreality@gmail.com. You can subscribe to the show at Podbean or iTunes or SoundCloud, wherever else you can find it. I'd also like to thank Heather Digby Parton at Hullabaloo, Crooks and Liars, and Smirking Chimp for letting me host the show at their prospective joints. I want to thank all of you fine human beings for tuning in this week. Have a good one. I say that enough. But me say some of them I say him just a go like a bee. It shocked the Duke, it shocked the Lord.